All right, and we are back with yet another episode here on the Culture and Sports Podcast. For those of you new to the show, I'm Wesley Livingston.
I'm Mike Scaramella.
And we are your hosts. And man, today's guest comes with a huge amount of knowledge and experience in elite athletics. She's a business owner, a coach, a mentor. She has a BA in sociology. She's a two-time medalist in the Pan American Games and a 2016 USA Olympic synchronized duet alternate. Please welcome Allie Williams. Allie, thank you so much for being here.
So, Allie,
yeah, thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, no, we're excited to have you. So we just kind of wanted to get started from the beginning. I know that you've done a lot of things to get to where you were, and we kind of want to start at the beginning and kind of just see, you know, where did your love for aquatics and sports and things like that get started?
Sure. Yeah, I grew up in Southern California, in a place called the San Fernando Valley, where it tends to get really hot during the summer. And I fell in love with the water as a way to escape the heat. But also, I think that it was the first place I ever really truly felt free. There was no expectations when I was in the pool to do anything specific. I could really just play and feel free. So, you know, my three favorite things were music, movement, and water. And I was pleasantly surprised to hear that there was an organized activity that combined all these things. So, you know, I hopped into to training for synchronized swimming and never looked back.
Wow, that's awesome. How were you introduced to it? Was it like a lot of your peers involved in it? Was it something that you kind of transitioned from another sport?
So my sister actually found the sport of synchronized swimming. I'd never heard of it until she mentioned it. And we had a family friend who did it that kind of gave us the idea. And I sort of followed in her footsteps. She actually went all the way to the Olympics and was a 2008 Olympian for Team USA. And I kind of followed in the path that she carved out.
Yeah, that's got to be like a pretty big thing. I mean, to watch somebody go and compete in the Olympics, it's like, you know, and then for you to go and do it right after that, that's pretty incredible. Just kind of, you know, step on the tracks and then just kind of fly through it. That's amazing. I'm pretty excited to talk to you about that as well. But I know that we had not always the greatest experiences, which kind of led us into where you are now. Can you go into a little bit of some of the experiences that you had when you were first coming up, and how you maybe were treated in the beginning, from when you started to kind of, you know, when you started getting into the more very competitive portions of it?
Sure. Yeah. So first, I just did the recreational level, and this was really stress free. But I think at that point in time, I was taking it a lot more seriously than anybody around me, like most of the other athletes and most of the coaches who were involved, mostly for recreation. But I had kind of this single-minded approach to wanting to be excellent, and I kept going with that. And then that led me onto a better team, a club team that had a group of athletes who, you know, wanted to go to Junior Olympics, and so that kind of really ramped up with the expectations. I remember my early coaches being, I would call them strict but fair. I never really felt any much conflict with them, and I just felt like they told me what to do, and I did it, and everybody was happy. It was kind of simple back in the beginning.
And how old were you when you started, you know, realizing, you know, your talents are a little bit, you know, better than
exceeded
the rest of the people around you in the pool? Like, how old were you when you kind of realized that you really wanted to take it to that next level?
Well, I think, you know, I started at age 10, and I already kind of was the top of the pack, even my first season in the recreational field. And I didn't really realize that what I was doing was abnormal, because there were people around me succeeding in the sport at the level I was. Like, for example, my friend who I mentioned earlier, who is also, you know, getting to the elite level. And the club team I ended up joining, the only reason I was even able to do it was because I had a carpool with a couple other girls who wanted to do it. And I mean, already by age 11, age 12, I was already pushing the limits, but I didn't really notice. I didn't notice until, I don't know, probably I quit and left the national team. It always seemed normal to me. I never really realized I was great at it. I actually still thought I was bad when I was on the national team. And it's only recently, really, that I realized it was not normal.
Oh, interesting. That's so when you did start and you started going, when did you like start getting really pushed? Because I know, I mean, it's a very physically demanding sport. A lot of people, you know, at the same time, you know, you don't think of it that way. But I know that, you know, what comes with that, I mean, there's a lot of different types of things, calisthenics, stretching, and things like that, that are actually more extreme than they would be in other sports.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think this started almost right away as soon as I joined a club team after my first year in the sport. I do remember athletes getting pushed into the splits until they were crying at practice and this sort of thing. It really amplified in my teenage years, like 14, 15, 16, when I went to train with a team in Riverside, which was 90 miles away from my home in Los Angeles. And the hours doubled, and the number of athletes doubled. The competitive environment felt like a lot more pressure. And I think that's when I really started feeling more pressure.
And were you still having fun at that time? Was it like something that you were still, you know, really, really motivated to do?
Yeah, I was. I was really motivated, and I think it was confusing. Some of the experiences I was having in it that felt negative to me were confusing with this motivation, and I didn't really have much of a way to vocalize or verbalize the confusing side of these experiences, because everyone was acting like it was normal.
That was what I was going to go into next. I remember reading something that I believe you wrote, and it was the same thing where, you know, you really didn't understand because nobody else was saying anything. It was just kind of felt like
the norm. Normal. Yeah, it seemed like the norm.
So would you say that, I mean, it was literally any other pressure from like other teammates? Nobody was really saying anything about this, right?
Yeah, we all just went along with it. I don't remember anyone else ever saying anything bad about the coaches or anything like this. I think we just kind of thought, oh, well, this is what it takes to get to be number one. And our team at that time was trying to win junior nationals, which had traditionally been dominated by two clubs in the Bay Area. So this was really new that our club was starting to win junior nationals. And I think it was just a given that we had to train harder and be stricter than those other clubs. And that was the only way to, you know, get to gold or whatever.
And in some of the research that I've done on the sport, as far as injuries, I didn't know that concussions were as big or as relevant as they were in the sport, and like shoulder injuries. What kind of injuries or anything did you experience during your time?
I did have some issues with overuse. I'm fortunate that I wouldn't call myself injury prone, and I did have good help early on. My mom was a physical trainer, and she got me started around age 16. She just kind of saw and realized, like, wow, you need a lot more strength to be able to do what you want to do in the water. So because I had that help, I did have a shoulder injury at that time. Overuse injuries are really common. Concussions are really common. I'm actually lucky that I didn't sustain one, but I had a lot of teammates go through injuries, and I did have other injuries in the course of my career that were, you know, kind of show stopping.
And it's pretty cutthroat. I mean, as soon as somebody gets injured, I mean, pretty much. I mean, on an Olympic team, I feel like, you know, they got to find somebody else to replace you. Do they like take you off the team? What's the situation with that?
They seem like the teams are so small and it's kind of limited. So I feel like it's mm-hmm. when I was in athletics, it was hard to take me out of the game. As an athlete, it's hard to take a kid out of, you know, the sport that he loves. But what about for?
Right. Yeah. I would say like there wasn't really much oversight, and there wasn't anyone really in charge of checking on athlete well-being, and athletes did not. So there's a power imbalance there, right? Because if you're an athlete and there's something wrong with you, whether it's emotional, physical, mental, whatever. You don't want to tell anybody because that could result in you not getting to compete, right? And these other people, your coaches, have power over you because they get to decide whether or not you play or swim in this case. So there wasn't anyone asking about our well-being, and we weren't ones to offer it. And so, yeah, exactly. Yeah. So this culture was created where you just didn't. It was kind of like a badge of pride to be a wounded warrior. Like, the more injured you could be and not tell anybody about it, the more proud the coach would be of you that you were being so courageous or something. It was kind of odd. Yeah.
And I feel like I could relate to that as well on a certain level. I mean, you get to a level and, you know, you made it so far, if you get injured, you tell a coach all that work that you've put in for so long. I mean, they could just be like, okay, well, sorry, you know, you're done. And then all that work that you put into it. So, I mean, you really strive, but I feel like that could be a real problem because, you know, then all of a sudden you're getting, you know, worse injuries than you had before. Your small concussion turns into something that could be potentially way worse than it could have been.
Did you feel expendable at any time? Was that another reason why, you know, injuries were...
Oh, I felt expendable at all times.
Yeah.
I don't think I ever didn't feel expendable. I mean, if there was something wrong with you, they would just kind of... I would compare it to being like a used piece of Kleenex. It's like, oh, this Kleenex is done. Just throw it off to the side. Just get a younger, better model who's not injured and won't speak up for themselves.
And they were pretty like physically like demanding of your appearance from what I've read. Can you go into a little bit about that? I mean, what they're looking for and you know, that kind of a thing.
Sure. Yeah. So the sport favors thin, flexible, white, tall women, preferably heterosexual and affluent. I personally find it to be one of the least inclusive Olympic sports. If you're not those things, you're more like the more of those qualities you have, the better. The ones you don't have, you're going to get harped on for. So if you weigh too much, you're going to get harped on for needing to lose weight. If you're too short, you're going to stand out to the coach of the group, and you're always going to be told you need to get higher. If your skin tone is... I don't think it's like if your skin tone's wrong, you won't get put in, but we did... I mean, there was a judge who told the coach of our junior national team in 2020, like, your athlete's skin tones are too disparate. So This is also a thing.
That's crazy to even think about right now.
Especially these days. You said in 2020. Like.
Right. It wasn't 30 years ago.
And that's what's interesting about it. It's just like, you know, you think that would be, you know, something that's totally off the table right now. Like, you know, that's crazy. But, but you know, it's they have their... I guess
their aesthetics is got to be
they want to have.
Yeah.
You wrote a thesis, and it was on, I believe, depression and emotional stress for athletes.
Emotional abuse.
Emotional abuse. And I feel like, you know, you have a lot of experience with that, and that's why you kind of obviously wrote the thesis on it. But did you ever feel like, you know, you had really, really good times throughout those portions where you're still having trouble with coaches and with other players? Were you still enjoying yourself like later on when you were in the super competitive portion of it?
Mm-hmm. So this might sound strange to you, but I don't really know. My brain definitely, and I know that this is a biological thing that we tend to remember negative events really well. I really remember mostly negative experiences. I'm sure there must have been times I was having fun or laughing. I'm sure. I don't really remember those times. I mostly remember negative experiences. I remember feeling severely depressed a long time along the way. And yeah, that's all I can say.
And did you remember those feelings? It was afterwards. Do you think it was in your older, like when you grew up a little bit, that you started to realize those things happened, or did you realize those things were happening in the moment? Or was it kind of like in hindsight you realized that's what was going on?
I would say very little awareness came at the time, and most of the awareness came afterwards. And it wasn't until afterwards that I started to reflect back and really realize, you know, how wrong a lot of the things that occurred were, applying, you know, my own lens after the fact. So I would say I had very little awareness at the time.
If you can go back and speak to your coaches about this type of thing, is it something that you think you might go back now and look back on and possibly bring up with them? Or do you think it would have been no use at all?
Well, so my analysis of it now is that I feel like the container of my training was a place for my coaches to play out their own traumas through power, control, and dominance. You know, without knowing their exact psychology, they seem to have a need to feel in control. This meant a lot of behavioral rules with harsh consequences for stepping outside. But a lot of the rules were actually abusive. Like, for example, don't touch the wall until we get this right. which, you know, if you're out in the water perpetually treading water for too long, like, I mean, at what point is it
dangerous?
Yeah. Well, if you're,
exactly. At what point is it dangerous? Being denied food, you know, food and water, you're prone to injury. Other coaching styles were abusive too, like being ignored. And I just, like, I can't imagine, especially at that time, I think people are starting to become more aware of those issues, but no, I absolutely could not imagine telling those coaches, I feel like you're playing out your own trauma through power, control, and dominance. I don't think that would have gone over well.
No, definitely probably wouldn't have. Definitely probably wouldn't have. So going back a little bit to your experience with the team, I really wanted to kind of know a little bit more. Did you guys have camaraderie as a team? I mean, I feel like, you know, we were always on a part of a team, and we felt like that was kind of a family. Did you feel that at all?
I felt that on, I can think of like one or maybe two seasons where I really felt camaraderie. And for two reasons. One is I didn't feel like I fit in. I do think now, looking back, that it was a jealousy issue, and that there were other athletes. I was so unaware of like my own quote unquote talent that I wasn't understanding this at the time, but I do quite frankly think other athletes and coaches didn't like me because of my light and my skills and my talent, that they felt threatened by this. You know, I was unaware of it at the time, but I didn't really fit in. I didn't feel like I fit in with the group. There was one season I did, maybe one season that I did. And then the second component of that is that, and then I actually found this in my research. So up until maybe about the year 2000, it seemed like there was a lot of camaraderie on the U.S. national teams. Somewhere around the year 2000, it seemed like something shifted and athletes were more divided against each other. And so prior to 2000, I think, you know, if a coach said something nasty, your teammate might give you a pat on the back and say, don't worry about it, you're doing fine.
Yeah.
But after 2000, I think something, my understanding is that something shifted and that there wasn't that anymore. And there kind of became this like suffer in silence approach. I remember my last season in particular training for the Olympics. Like, I just felt like, I mean, me and one other swimmer in particular, I know was miserable. I can't speak for all the members of the team, but we even talked about this at one point, that you didn't really share what you were going through because there was nothing the other athlete could really do about it. And it was kind of like, they're struggling with their own things. Why would I complain to them? This isn't going to accomplish anything.
Both struggle in silence, basically. Do you think this was kind of common around Olympic sports in general, not just U.S. Olympic teams? Did you kind of see some of these antics or kind of toxic organizations sometimes with other teams?
Do you mean in other sports or in other countries?
In other countries, even other sports. Do you kind of see this as like a common thing in like aquatic sports, or is it a USA thing, or do you?
Other countries, I think, would consider us soft. Like, they would be surprised to hear me complaining about the way I was treated. They would think, like, really? What are you even talking? They wouldn't even know what I was talking about. Yeah. I know an athlete who was on the Ukrainian national team at the same time I was on the U.S. national team, and the things she described as what was said to her and how training were seemed even more intense and negative than any way that I was treated.
Wow.
And then I had a Russian coach once who went to like three and a half Olympics or something. And so she's a three-time gold medalist. And she just told me she just got used to like floating at her nose. She said there was a whole period of time. You just don't speak. Like, you just become a robot. And, you know, your thoughts and opinions are not welcome at all. And so you just, she said she floated at her nose because she actually learned not to laugh either. Laughing was not going to go over well with the coach. So countries like Russia, China, Ukraine, probably Japan as well, I imagine to be even more strict than the United States. Other countries, I don't know so much. As far as other sports, I think it depends on what type of sport. So I find that are subjectively judged performance sports tend to be the most, have the most of these characteristics of abuse. I went to the youth Olympic Winter Games last year, right before COVID, with Team USA.
Nice.
And yeah, it was a lot of fun, and I was hanging out. So it's all different sports, right? And I'm hanging out with these figure skaters, snowboarders, skiers, and the figure skaters were closer to, I think, my experience. But the skiers and snowboarders, I think, wouldn't be able to relate because their sport is not based on being so precise.
More an individual sport as well.
Yeah, and it's based a lot on, like, creativity and getting pumped up and, like, being in the right zone before you do your run. So I noticed a lot more of the coaches, I think, like, encouraging the athletes, trying to get them in good spirits before their run because that seemed to be the most important thing. Whereas with us, the obsession is with being precise. So
not, and so not so much creative, not so much creative on that.
Exactly.
Which is funny. Cause I've been on a bunch of super, I played baseball. So on a bunch of super competitive teams. And I figured really actually every team that we did really well, we actually had, a good mindset. We had, team camaraderie, things like that. A lot of the other teams that, I was on, it was the same kind of thing. It was just like super competitive. You're worried about this person taking your position. It was stressful all the time. It's a lot different in those specific areas. So I think it's definitely interesting kind of the way it just plays out over time.
Yeah, absolutely. And one thing I find interesting is that I believe and I'm confident that joy is a stronger motivator than fear. But it does take a little more time and a lot more patience. And so many coaches do not have this. I just don't think they have the capacity for it, maybe based on the way they were treated or just what they have an idea about what works.
Right.
But there are coaches that have proven that positive culture in sports can result in winning, like Pete Carroll with the Seattle Seahawks, Steve Kerr with the Golden State Warriors, Phil Jackson doing meditation with the Lakers. Valerie Kondo's field with UCLA women's gymnastics. There are people who are proving that you can coach the whole person first and the athlete second. And not only will you still win, but your athletes are going to be more well-rounded people.
Absolutely.
And then kind of going into it, I mean, after you've had all these negative experiences, you're coming out of it with something so positive. You started a business, you've done some things. Why don't you kind of tell us what you're doing now out there in Hawaii?
Yeah, I know you just had something recently out there. It was a teens retreat and a retreat for masters mm-hmm. this past summer. Why don't you kind of tell us about how that went and if you have any, plans for any future events?
Yeah, I would love to. So, we actually had started planning before COVID and then went through a lot of uncertainty with having to postpone the event a whole year during COVID. But it finally happened this past July after a year and a half of planning. My business partner, Ashley, and I, who's also a former synchronized swimmer, but in a different area, we put this together. And the idea was to focus on the light. I call it focusing on the light side instead of the shadow side. So for me, the shadow side is focusing on competition in comparison with others. And I feel that myself and probably others who were raised in the same system I was have already done a lot of exploration of these concepts. And I wanted to explore, and Ashley, we wanted to explore synchronized swimming as, or artistic swimming as it's been rebranded to, as a vehicle of wellness and creative expression. So that was the idea behind the events. And they were really fun. I mean, they were all full. We had we originally had one teenage summer camp and one adult retreat, and then the teenage summer camp filled, so we added a second one.
Nice.
Yeah, it was really cool.
But yeah, I didn't even plan on having an extra one. It just kind of popped up that way and just was popular right away.
Yeah.
We had a waiting list, and once we got a certain number of people on the waiting list, we said, all right, let's open a third event, and then that one filled up as well.
Nice.
That's all you can hope for, So do you have anything planned in the future?
Near future here, any other events that you have that you think that you're going to plan?
Well, we have already decided to repeat these events for next year. And I do think they are the only events in Hawaii, I think, at this time for artistic swimming. And I think they're the only artistic swimming events I know of that are focused on this aspect of the sport. So I do expect them to grow in popularity because I think we're not the only people who are a little bit like bored of this kind of neurotic perfectionist side of the activity and want to explore more of the fun creative side. And not to say nobody else is doing that. There are absolutely other people doing that in their own way, in their own place, but not really so much in a formal organized fashion. And you know, the athletes really liked it. You could tell they had a little trouble grasping what it was at first, because I think it was so different than what they knew. But it was really cool seeing as the, so we also practiced singing at these events, and as the events went along, they were making a lot more verbal expression, and a lot, they burst into song even. Witness them coming out of their show.
And that's one of the things that you found joy in being, song, dance, water.
That's what brought you to the sport.
And I feel like, yeah, you're bringing that forward to, you know, these kids, and you're kind of just kind of letting them explore it for themselves, which is, it's good. Cause you know, it's hard to kind of get into something like that unless, you know, it's promoted or it's out there. So
you're exposed to it. Yeah,
exactly.
And you're pushing it in a positive light. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so we'll do those events again, and then moving forwards, I'm also going to go to Cancun in December with like my own master's teammates. So back in Los Angeles in 2019, there's a pretty big mermaid tribe. My sister and I and other ladies, working professionals, mothers, someone just got her PhD. It's a really cool group of women.
Is that the group of artistic swimmers? The mermaid squad, is that, you called it the mermaid squad? Is that a group of like artistic swimmers? Okay, yeah. Cool. Okay.
How many in the group?
I mean, I think probably anywhere between 10 and 25, depending on how people come and go from LA.
Oh, nice.
Awesome.
And at Cancun, I'd imagine most people would like to come to that one.
Yeah, that we definitely have, I think we have at least 12 people going to that event. So we have a performance group that does shows at kind of any event that has water could hire us to do routines, like a birthday party, corporate event, wedding, whatever. If there's water, people want entertainment, we can do it. So that's kept us together as a tribe. And then in the competitive environment in 2019, we went to Masters Nationals in Tupelo, Mississippi, which was a lot of fun. And so now we're getting the gang back together to go to Cancun. And that is the first time I've been on a team that really had the feeling of what I've always thought a synchronized swimming team could be, which is women like really, really, really uplifting each other.
And that's how it should be. I mean, like I said, I feel like, you know, and I was just going to say, I was just going to ask you that question. Do you feel more camaraderie, and are you enjoying this more than you were when you were, you know, competing as an Olympian?
Absolutely. Yeah, it feels a lot more fun. It feels a lot more creative. Both of the women who I did my events with in Kona are going. And so it's kind of this crossover of these women that I know and overlap with in different ways in my life. Sometimes we perform together. Now we're doing a competition together. Kind of having this group of people to almost travel through life with, I think, is something that makes this sport really unique compared to other sports that you can't really do later in life. That's kind of a unique aspect of our sport.
Absolutely. And I think it'd be like just super valuable to like just get that to the kids right away. I mean, if we could stop, you know, the toxic environments of, you know, being so pressured to do some of these things and all that stuff, you know, obviously there's going to be good competition. You got to work hard, but you know, I feel like you should never have to feel like that. I mean, that's ridiculous. So for you bringing it out and being able to bring, you know, girls and women out of that super strict, kind of a realm, I mean, it's really cool what you're doing. So, I mean, I'm sure a lot of people are thankful that you're able to do that and just changing lives, I'm sure.
Thank you. Appreciate that that encouragement. Yeah, I've always thought it was strange that I feel like sports teams are geared towards the people who want to be uber competitive, which realistically, I mean, that's probably 5% of people who play the sport at all. Maybe 95% are there for all the other reasons to have something to do after school, to make friends, to all these other things that people are trying to be in shape, to like get, work out. And but if we could just stop gearing all of training for the 5%, like it should still be available to those who really want it, because there are the 5% who really want to, like, you know, go elite or whatever.
Right.
But I just like to see more recreational activities, because most of people who do sports don't do it for the competition.
Yeah, and this one, I mean, what you were involved in wasn't really recreation at all. You were going to compete. So that's definitely a little bit different, and I could definitely see there being more like recreational versions of that. And then, you know, people can transition, you know, into the other stuff later on once they get, you know, more into it. I feel like you were just kind of thrown into a super, super competitive area of it, which has got to be tough.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think just more of a sense of letting the athlete lead about and really co-creating with the coach, like what experience the athlete's really ready for, because there were a lot of, my research showed that athletes on the same team could have really different experiences. So let's say you, Wes and Mike, are on the same team and one of you reports back, that was awful, I feel abused, I'm never doing the national team again. And let's say Mike, who was on the same team over the same summer, says, that was great, loved the coach, moving to go train with that coach full time. Literally, the research showed this.
Huh.
And I think it has a lot to do, well, it has a lot to do with personalities and many other factors, but I think there's a readiness. And if an athlete's really ready and they understand, like, this is what it takes to get to the next level, it's going to be a little bit more strict, but it can still be fair. Doesn't need to be, there doesn't need to be yelling, there doesn't need to be threatening. I mean, who really thinks to themselves, yeah, wow, when my coach ignored or threatened me, like, it just brought out my best. No, it's confusing. Nobody ever thought that.
Nobody ever thought
infuriated me, like, yeah, absolutely infuriated me.
It infuriated me, right? So, yeah, I think there's evaluating readiness and then just being more more real and more present and less, bringing less emotional charge to the playing field, which, I mean, the coach shouldn't really be bringing an emotional charge, and I think that's where, like, emotional intelligence comes in.
So are you taking the reins almost as a coaching or like mentor to these people, and especially in the Hawaiian, in the and what you were just doing out there? Do you think that that's going to be kind of an issue?
What do you mean?
So I mean, I'm just thinking in general, like, if are you being more like on the coaching side of things? Like, are you wearing a couple of hats? Whereas you're coaching, you obviously set it up. You're mentoring these girls, these women. So what kind of hats are you wearing, kind of for your project that you're working on?
Mm-hmm. Well, I have been a coach in different capacities for about 8 years now. And I was coaching athletes who wanted to do national team trials and all that kind of stuff. And my interest in that has waned. Like, if there's an athlete that really comes to me and says, I want to prepare for national team trials, I know you've done it 9 times, can you help me get ready? That would be one thing. But otherwise, that world is kind of a little bit boring to me, honestly, at this point. Like, I can teach the techniques, I know them like the back of my hand, but I'm more interested in the mentorship component. And so when I coach, it's through that lens. And this is actually the first time in a while I haven't been coaching full time, because there's no synchro teams in Hawaii. So I'm not coaching full time. I'm not sure how that'll be moving forwards, but I'm definitely more interested in the mentorship component, which to me is like, this activity we're doing, artistic swimming, is really just a vehicle to have experiences and then get to reflect on those experiences in a way that may help this young athlete grow. And actually, also, I don't really think my role as a coach is to be some kind of guru or to have the answer to everything. I think my job is actually to provide what I call a container, which is an environment that this being, this kid or whoever, can feel safe to have their own experiences and have me as a sounding board when needed. I don't think it's like so much like me doing everything or telling them everything.
Yeah, no, I definitely see that. I think it's more of an important role to begin with anyway. And at least, you know, while you're out there, it's nice that, you know, they don't have anything that bogs you down as a coach, where you actually have some time to work on other things like this and kind of just perfect that craft as well.
Yeah, I really appreciate coaching in the non-competitive environment. Because I've actually found it to not really be less excellent per se, but it's a lot more, I don't know, just my theory is like, when these kids go to college, I'm not going to be there with them. No coach is going to be there with them. They're going to have to learn how to do their own laundry and get themselves a class and get their homework done and all this stuff. And so I don't really understand why the model of coaching kids now is this like kind of babysitting model where they're expected to not talk, listen, do everything you say. I don't understand how this prepares them for life. So I'm not really sure how I'll coach moving forward. I know I want to do these events, and I know I want to still be in a position of mentorship to especially young women. But you know, it might even be outside of sports. Like, I'm actually currently living at a retreat center in Hawaii, and I've just become the program director here, which is my first job. Time taking on a job that's outside the sport of artistic swimming. Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you. Awesome. Yeah, and I'd love to be part of events that are personal growth and development based, that just kind of remove competition entirely and are really focused more on where the individual is now and what their next stage of growth might be.
Awesome. I had a question. Just what advice would you give to a parent? I have a 1-year-old daughter now, and for future reference, what kind of advice would you give to a parent, you know, to kind of recognize, you know, some of these, you know, toxic environments or like any of these kind of situations? What would you recommend to a parent?
Sure, that's a great question. I would ask your kid more questions about how practice is going, what they're doing at practice, not in an obsessive way, but I think like a targeted way. Hey, how is your relationship with your coach? Do you feel like you guys are treating each other respectfully? Hey, do you feel like you're having opportunities for your voice to be heard and you're, you know, at practice? Hey, how are you getting along with your teammates? Do you feel like you're part of the group? Or, you know, you can vary it based on what the activity is,
yeah,
but
absolutely.
I think kind of more specific questions to understand what's going on.
Well, it's definitely important, because you were saying earlier you almost kept everything to yourself. Did you ever say anything to your parents when you were having issues, or did they not even you know, really bring it up? So it's kind of hard, because it's not like, you know, you expect and you hope that your coach is doing the right thing, but it's not always the case, and it's just like, you know, it's a lot of pressure to go out and talk to somebody and say, hey, like, this is happening, without somebody asking the questions, like you said.
Right. Like, I don't think I talked to my mom or my dad much about these things. I do remember there was a time that I asked to quit, and my mom told me no. At the time, her reasoning was wanting me to stick out the rest of the season. And she's told me later in life, you know, I really regret not letting you quit at that time. I didn't understand how unhappy you were, that you were actually like in full on depression. I didn't really know. Yeah, and I think, you know, parents, they do know their kids, though. So I guess just pay attention, because if you've got a kid that's naturally a certain way and then they're not, like, let's say you have a kid who's naturally happy and boisterous and exuberant, and then you would kind of notice if something's changing. So ask about that. But I don't think my mom ever asked me, like, hey, are you being denied food and water at practice? Because it did not occur to her that this was happening.
And you're, at this point, you're driving to Riverside, right? It's not like you're just right there and you can get some food right away. It's like, oh, well, we're actually, yeah, that's rough. That's got to be rough. I can't believe they even did that.
Right. Yeah, that was kind of a theme throughout all the national teams, just like skipping lunch, this sort of thing. If something wasn't going well in the pool, we would just use the lunch break to try to solve it, which I don't know that really was an effective strategy.
Yeah, it's not a great, doesn't sound like a good strategy to me.
Not at all.
Not at all. Do you see things changing right now with other coaches? Have you been able to experience watching other coaches, things like that, and have you seen anything different from, you know, when you were competing?
And
now
you're working with other coaches as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, I did visit the National Training Center. I had been working with the CEO of USA Artistic Swimming in regards to this research, the thesis, and part of that was visiting the National Training Center and presenting the research to the coaches there. I would say, like, awareness has definitely gone up, especially because there was a New York Times article in March that really painted the sport in an unfavorable light. Actually, it was written by a former synchronized swimmer, and she interviewed, like, more than 50 athletes from a dozen countries, and they were all saying the same thing about the way that they were treated and the comments that were getting made to them and how abusive it was. And I could definitely tell that shook the container of the sport. You could tell that this affected people. And so awareness is up. Right now, it's a lot of talk. I'm not really sure how much action. For example, the most recent Junior Olympics, which is the biggest competition in the country for, you know, the good teenagers, it was held at altitude and in Colorado. And athletes were really struggling because I don't know if you guys know this, but you hold your breath in this sport.
Yeah, altitude doesn't help.
Yeah, and they were at altitude, and there was kind of this question over, like, were the athletes really okay? And I guess if you did have to go to the hospital, and at some point throughout, they implemented a policy that said that athletes could basically take 30 seconds off to rest in the middle of the routine because they were having so many issues with athletes feeling like, or actually passing out. And yeah. I just don't know how much, we say the rhetoric coming out from the organization is that safety is really a priority, but I'm just not sure if it really is.
Yeah. But, you know, at least, it sounds like you've brought in awareness to a lot of people. A lot of people even if they're just talking about it right now, it's obviously be better if they're implementing, a lot of the things that, that you're showing and things like that. But, it's just a good conversation. It's a good starting point, I feel like. And hopefully it just kind of keeps moving in the right direction. Do you see it kind of keep moving forward? Are you seeing it progress fairly quickly?
Well, I think one thing that's important to remember is, like, my lens is it can seem really negative to some. And I've had people tell me, why is your lens so negative? Synchro's a beautiful sport. What's your problem? And I'm sure she's going to listen to this podcast and make the same nasty comments, but no worries. That's beside the point. So my lens is negative because my experiences on the national team were very negative, but I want to emphasize that there's a lot of great coaches out there who have taught synchronized swimming in really positive ways to their athletes, and it's important to kind of like present that side of things as well, and absolutely, hopefully those types of coaches will be supported continue to grow as far as are things headed in a positive direction. I see that there is a movement that's not just in synchronized swimming, like even what's going on with gymnastics and Simone Biles withdrawing from her competitions at the Tokyo Olympics because she had the twisties and didn't feel like she could perform. I think that was really powerful because in that moment, sports can be a really unequal power structure where the athletes don't have a lot of power. And what she did is she said, no, actually I am empowered and it is my choice whether I compete or not.
Absolutely. And
so in that movement energetically did, I think, kind of harmonize a hierarchical system to be less hierarchical. So I don't know. I would like to be hopeful. I would like to be hopeful.
Yeah. No, I mean, it sounds like it's at least going in the right direction, which is a really good start. And, as much as you could do, I like the fact that you keep on throwing these events. You're mentoring these kids, these women. Do you still keep in contact with a lot of the ones? So I know you just recently got done. Are you staying in contact with a lot of the athletes that you work with?
Yeah, absolutely. And social media does make it, much easier to connect. Yeah. We just sent out a survey that came back with a lot of, really cute responses. People loved, honestly, they loved their free time in their cabins with each other, like, the most.
And the dolphin tour. Right? Friends, the stuff that you had that you kind of missed out on, which is unfortunate.
Exactly. We just got that survey back, and I'm sure we'll stay in touch. And I do have athletes that over the years I have more mentored on a long-term basis and, consider to be, some have grown up and are even friends now. And that's always really sweet to be able to continue those relationships and be part of watching a young woman grow up into a woman.
That's awesome. Her name escapes me, but you did a Q&A with a swimmer, and I can't remember her name, but you had, was that part of another camp that you had? I think it was on like a Zoom meeting.
Oh, yeah. So that was, I was coaching Nova Synchro in Arlington, Virginia, a lot of online stuff during the pandemic. And Andrea Fuentes came on. She's the current head coach of the U.S. national team. And she's like the most decorated Spanish Olympian of all times. So she kind of has that clout of being someone who's won Olympic medals. So she can say, like, I do know what it takes to win. And she definitely treated the athletes in her time, like the last 3 years on the national team, in my opinion, better than they were treated during my era. And actually the research shows that as well, because I did survey the athletes who were on the national team about a year ago, and they seemed better emotional and mental shape. So that's definitely progress. Like, how much can she do as one person against an entire system. I'm not really sure yet, but she definitely has a lot of novel approaches for how to motivate athletes without using fear as a technique.
And I appreciate Have you been like working with her quite a bit on like making like having getting new techniques, things like that to train the girls and women that you guys are working with?
We have collaborated together several times. Not recently because she was so busy getting ready for the Tokyo Olympic qualifier and the Olympics. But we have collaborated together several times, and we could potentially in the future as well.
Do you think you're seeing a change because a lot of the coaches now were, you know, ex-players before, and they, you know, kind of want to change the whole culture of the sport as well? Do you think that's, as time goes on, as players go into coaching, do you think that's why the change is kind of happening as it's happening?
Yeah, I think that's definitely part of the reason. I mean, there are a lot of former athletes that are involved in various ways, maybe on the board of USA Synchro or USA Artistic Swimming, or maybe as coaches that are doing things in a more positive way. I think the best analogy is honestly politics. Like, think about who's running the country, think about their average age, and then think about it. There's kind of this old guard that's hanging on, and it feels to me like they don't want to let go of control, and they don't really want to let the new in.
You see it in baseball a lot, or
yeah, you got me.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and then there's kind of all the other people who are like ready to do this new way, and you know, eventually it'll hit a saturation point, right?
Yeah, and that's, you know, that's what you could, you know, you hope for, especially right there, because I mean, I feel like the more coaches you have that do well, the more you're gonna get in the future, and you're gonna get more people that are like, hey, look, I love that coach. And maybe that'll drive their career to be a coach, just like kind of you got driven to just be like, you know, an inspiration to a lot of people because you had the bad experiences. You're able to talk about them and you're able to kind of fix them, maneuver them. And it's really interesting to see that perspective because I really haven't met too many people that had a really bad experience and going up and sticking with it like you did, like a champion. That's amazing.
Thank you.
Yeah, no worries. I mean, it's pretty crazy. And then just to see that you're helping so many people now, I mean, it's got to feel good.
Awesome.
I mean, do you like just feel so much better about like, you know, where you were in the past because of where you are now?
I think so. I think these last events in Kona in July were a breakthrough for me that I felt like, wow, you know, 47 people came to Hawaii all the way from the mainland United States, like just to learn from me and my co-facilitators, Ashley and Audra. And that felt like my Olympics. So for example, you know, I was the Olympic alternate, right? So there was three of us, two people got to actually swim. I got, you know, I was the third, and that's what they got. They got to actually swim in the Olympics and compete and perform. Maybe that was their Olympics, their kind of culminating activity. But these events were actually at the same time as the Tokyo Olympics. And I remember thinking to myself, like, this is kind of my Olympics. This is my culmination for everything that I put in is now getting to transfer this and transmute these energies and be able to have access to and provide this positive experience for so many people. And that definitely felt meaningful.
Absolutely. I didn't realize that people were, I mean, because I knew you were doing it out there in Hawaii. I didn't know if you're just, you know, working with the local population, people that were there. I didn't realize people were flying out. I mean, that's incredible.
Yeah, thank you. It was a lot of trust to have to gain COVID.
Figure out right, yeah, exactly.
Why do you think Hawaii doesn't have like a real organized, synchronized swimming team? Why?
You know, the place where I live, the median income is like $12,000 a year. I don't think it's like these cities in on the mainland that have these high income people who are putting their kids in all these sports and this and that. It's a very different culture here. Not to say they're not interested in sports. I don't know if they are or not, but there are not really any other mermaids either. So I like to swim in natural bodies of water now, and I actually make more art. I actually just uploaded a new piece of art to my YouTube yesterday that I'm pretty excited about. It's just me in the ocean with a GoPro. But I think I'm the only artistic swimmer here, and I don't know exactly why that is. I don't really There is a local pool. I know they're doing like one lane only during the pandemic, and I don't know if they run it out. But I guess somebody could try to get that going.
Huh. Like, why not me, right?
Yeah, I'm probably better. It's probably a better fit to me to run these events and be able to touch a lot of people in a short amount of time that way in this immersive environment, because I do think it's really good for me to actually focus on a profession that's now outside of artistic swimming and to develop a different side of myself.
Yeah, that's a good idea, and it's definitely nice because you already have that experience, so now you can move on and actually use those experiences to just benefit yourself and your business and your new endeavors that you choose to take on, which is amazing. So, how much longer are you out in Hawaii? Are you going to be out there for a while? Are you going to plan on coming back and doing any events here, anything like that? In the States?
I would like to come to LA soon to visit friends and family. I would like to do an event in San Diego for some masters athletes out there. These really badass group of women that train in the ocean. They're like in their 60s. They're really cool. They're next level. Yeah. And I want to do an event with them. I'd like to do an event in Puerto Rico that's more friendly to the LGBTQ community. There's someone out there I'd like to partner up with to do an event out there. We'll see. We'll see where the sports always taken me in, these directions that I didn't plan. So we'll see what's next. I'm still interested in working in the sport. But for now, I am really feeling at home and safe in Hawaii, and I don't have any plans to leave other than for trips.
All right, you ripped that home flight ticket away, huh? You ripped that up.
Exactly.
Like, had to go.
Yeah.
Well, Ali, thank you so much for, I don't want to take up any more of your time. We've been on here for a little bit, but thank you so much for, talking about your time, your experiences, and you're sharing your time with us today. So
yeah, and best of luck to you. I mean, I know that you're already touching lives, so I mean, keep doing what you're doing, and I do believe we'll probably want to follow up with you soon and see where you're going and maybe even get you on again to talk about what you're doing here in the future.
Yeah, that'd be great. I appreciated talking to both of you so much. Thanks for your unique perspectives, and it's been fun.
Absolutely.
All right, Ali, thank you so much.
Thank you.